Bandwidth for the Afterbeat is provided by FeedBurner. Find the Afterbeat at iTunes and on SoundCloud. And at www.afterbeatpod.com. If you're building a website, I recommend Squarespace, the secret behind exceptional websites. Check them out at www.squarespace.com. The Afterbeat with Rick Fleischman. Episode number one, Roy McCurdy. You know, I have really no idea what all this stuff does here. In fact, we're going to... Some guy just left it here one night, and I said, oh, man, I can do that.
Oh, yeah, let me hook it up here.
Yeah, let me hook it up. Well, no, if you actually had to hook it up, then I'd really... You know, I wouldn't know what to do with that. I'm a guitar player, you know.
Hey.
I'm a man of little brain.
Yeah. You aren't up on all this stuff, huh?
You know, I am. I have.
You
to
are
be.
Now, yeah.
No, I have been. You know, when you play electric guitar, it's like, you know, you first start plugging things in, and then you go, well, how could I plug that other thing in? And before you know it, you're the guy in charge of plugging things in everywhere you go. Drummers don't have to worry about
that.
No,
we don't have to do all that kind of stuff. We're good.
Can you hit this thing? Yeah, I can hit this thing. Okay, man, sit here and hit that thing. You know,
just give me some AC for my stand light, that's all.
Right, your stand light and your, do you carry a fan with you? A lot of drummers carry a fan.
No, I don't carry a fan.
Yeah. A lot of drummers
do. I like
to
sweat, so I don't care.
You hang tough.
I hang tough.
Talking with Roy McCurdy here, great drummer. He hangs tough. And he's hung tough with Cannonball Adderley. My God, Cannonball Adderley.
Yeah, man.
And how long have you been with Nancy Wilson?
Nancy, 31 years.
Hmm. So most of my life, you've been with Nancy. Three-fifths of my life, you've been with Nancy Wilson. Or no, half my life, I'm 60. You've been with Nancy Wilson. Yeah, that's cool, man.
Yeah, 31 years. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that like? Is that cool?
Yeah, that's a cool gig. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a good band, John B. Williams and Lou Matthews. That's the band now. It's been together for about 20 years. Mike Wolf used to be the piano player in that band. And so that's what it is now. You know, we aren't doing as much as we used to do, but we're still, you know, out there hitting it.
Yeah, I'm sure if she wanted to work more, she could work every night.
She could work as much as she wants to. Yeah. She's just slowed down now, so that's good because it's given us a chance to do a lot of other things, you know.
Yeah,
things
cool.
We want to do.
Cool, and you can have a life, you know.
I have a life, yeah. I don't have to be on the airplane all the time.
Any day without an airplane is a good day as far as I'm
concerned. It's a good day,
I'm
telling you, man. I don't mind going, you know, traveling and doing the gigs. I just mind going there.
Yeah.
You know, the transportation.
Coming in and coming back.
Mm.
It's never been my favorite.
Yeah.
So, Cannonball.
Yeah.
Yeah. How'd that happen?
Cannonball happened, I had met Cannon probably around 1959, 60, maybe before that. I was in the service, but I was home on leave. I met Cannon.
Mm-hmm.
We went up to Toronto to watch him play. I'm from Rochester, New York.
Yeah.
And, I met him up there for briefly, and then when I came out the service in 1960, I joined this band up in Rochester. We were playing around, and it eventually turned into Chuck Mangione's band.
Ah, so you were the brothers with the Mangione Brothers Gap.
And, it was called the Jazz Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a series on Riverside Records called Cannonball Adderley Presents. Series, and they would present new artists,
right.
And that's when we ran into him again, you know. But I had before that, I had been playing with the jazz, Ted Art, Farmer Benny Goes, Betty Carter, a whole bunch of different people, Kenny Dorham.
Well, so these were like big people. How did you get from being like a cat out of the service to playing with household names? I mean, there's a missing link in between there. You know?
Well, we went to New York with the Jazz Brothers.
Yeah.
With the Mangione Brothers. We played the five spot.
Mm-hmm.
And we did about a week or so at the five spot, and then we came back to Rochester. When I got back to Rochester, I got a telegram from Benny Golson, who had actually from Art Farmer, who had come to see the band at the five spot because Chuck was like a little trumpet prodigy at that time. And he called me and he said, he gave me the telegram and he said, we'd like you to come down to New York and join our band, the Jazz Tet.
It's a real classic story.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
So I said, okay, great. And I got in, you know, got in my car and we drove on down there and told everybody they have big, had a big old party and stuff. So, yeah, McCurdy's leaving Rochester. He's going to join the jazz tent. Art Farmer Benny Golson.
Made the big time.
Big time. And I got down there, and they put me up in the Elvin Hotel, which was right across the street from Birdland. Mm-hmm. And I had a notice to walk, to be over at Birdland at a certain time because we were going to audition at Birdland. I mean, join the band at Birdland.
Yeah.
When I got across the street, there was a whole bunch of guys standing out there. And Benny was one of them. He says, "Oh, you must be Roy McCurdy, the Rochester Flash."
The Rochester Flash.
Yeah. And I said, "Yeah, I came down to join." He says, "Well, this is an audition." They didn't say it was an audition. They said, "Just come down and join our band."
Yeah.
So I said, "Oh, man, I told everybody I'm coming down here." And this is, so it's an audition. So everybody went in and played. And at the end of the audition time, he came in and told me that I had the gig. Anyway, so yeah. I worked with them. That was my first band. They had the Art Farmer Benny Golson Jazz Tet.
So how old were you?
Ooh, it's probably early 20s, really early.
So did you record with the band too, or was it a live thing?
Yeah, we did. We did about 3 or 4 albums with the band.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah. And a couple of albums with Benny and Art individually. Yeah. It was really nice.
Right. Yeah. That's a great break for a kid just out of the service, right?
Yeah. And that's what it led to. So I went to there from Art Farmer Benny Golson. And then I started working with Betty Carter. And then while I was still with Art, I was working with Betty at the same time. And, I went home to try to straighten up. I was married, so I went home and tried to straighten up my marriage because I was always gone and different things like that. And so I stopped playing. This was 1962. And I stopped playing for a while. And while I was home, I got a call from Cannonball saying, "Come down and we'd love for you to come down and join our band. It's being a change and we want you to be the drummer." And that's how I became the drummer with that band in 1964.
So how did Cannonball hear about you?
Well, he had seen me play with all these other different people after that.
Yeah.
Because I was with Jazz Tet. I was playing with Betty Carter, but I was also with Sonny Rollins for a year before that.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So who was in Sonny's band when you were there?
It was me, Bob Cranshaw, that was at me, Bob Cranshaw, and Sonny.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was Ron Carter and Sonny.
Yeah. Was it Jim Hall on playing guitar?
No,
or was that before that band?
That was after that band.
Oh, after.
Yeah, this was 1963.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then Herbie was on the band for a while, and Paul Blay was on the band.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Playing with some pretty good people. So that's Chuck and Gap, and anybody else we know from that?
Well, there was... Jerry Nywood was in that band.
He died, right?
Yeah,
in a plane crash 2 years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ron Carter was in that band for a while, but because he was studying at Eastman School of Music at that time. Pee Wee Ellis.
Yeah.
You remember Pee Wee Ellis?
Sure.
Wayman Reed at Play Trumpet. He played in those bands.
Good band.
In that band. I mean, it was just a lot of guys coming through, changing
passing all through, right?
Yeah, it hadn't really become Chuck's band yet.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was just all these guys were playing together. Then when it became Chuck's band, it was Jerry Nywood, Gap, myself, a bass player named Bill Saunders, and Sal Nistico.
Hmm.
Yeah,
good guys.
Yeah, and that was the band that became the Jazz Brothers.
Right, right.
And we did a couple albums with them, and that's the band we traveled to New York with.
Yeah. So you leave that, you're out with... Art Farmer Benny Golson.
Art with Benny for a while. Stayed with them for about a year or so, and joined Sonny Rollins' band.
Yeah,
stayed with Sonny for a little over a year, and in 1964, I came back out. I stopped playing. Went back to Rochester for a few months, and got a call from Cannon to come down and join his band. So that's what I did. You know.
So that's Cannon and Nat. And what?
It was Cannonball, Nat.
Joe Zawinul?
Joe Zawinul and Sam Jones and myself.
Good band.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And Charles Lloyd was on that band when I first joined, but he wasn't there long. It was a sextet.
Yeah. So is that the band that cut Mercy Mercy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're on that?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. That's not the band actually that cut Mercy. We did that a little later.
Yeah.
Walter Booker was the bass player on that was it Walter? Yeah, I think Walter Booker was playing bass on that.
So it's before Sam, or
that was after Sam.
After Sam.
Yeah, what happened is when I joined Cannon, Lewis Hayes had left to go. He was the drummer. He had left to go with Oscar Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a big change, huge change, because those guys had been with these bands for a long time.
Oh yeah, people stuck with gigs a long time in those days. Yeah.
So when I got that gig, man, it was just a great gig, you know. So, and then Sam and I were together on that band for about maybe 6 months or so. He stayed, and then he left and joined Oscar Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that rip. And when he joined, Herbie Lewis came on the band as the bass player.
Right. So Cannonball was kind of a star, I mean, as far as jazz people
big
went
star.
In those days. Yeah,
big star.
So what was that like? Was that like all of a sudden you're traveling in a higher class, or?
Well, you know, all those guys were stars. Sonny, all those guys were big stars.
But I mean, Cannonball got played on the radio and stuff too. I mean, he was something that even non-jazz fans knew. I mean, like my dad knew who Cannonball was.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, it was great. I loved it. You know, especially after we made that record Mercy Mercy Mercy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was unbelievable. It sold so many records.
Right.
I think the only other person that sold as many records at that time was Ramsey Lewis, and they had
In Crowd
going on out there.
Yeah.
So when we pulled in the towns, I mean, the clubs were just packed.
Yeah, it's like a rock star thing.
Yeah, packed. Yeah. There'd be lines going down the street to get in for guys to come in.
So Mercy Mercy, as I recall, was kind of a left turn for Cannon. I mean, it wasn't typical of what he'd been playing before.
Right.
So how was that? I mean, were you around when, like, did Joe come to Cannonball and say, hey, I got this funky thing? Or how'd that come
about?
That's
exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
We rehearsed in Nat's basement all the time. We're in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And by this time, I had moved to Teaneck, so mm-hmm. I was in Teaneck also. But yeah, we rehearsed in Nat Adderley's basement, and Joe came in with this tune. He said, check this out. He says, I got this tune, and I'd like to try it. And we did. He played it down on the piano,
mm-hmm.
and Cannon liked it, and Nat liked it. Sometimes, you know, they always bring in tunes.
Right.
And some they would keep, and some they would reject. And they liked that tune, and Cannon was kind of blues orientated anyway.
Yeah.
He loved the blues and kind of thing. So he said, great, let's try it. And we did. And we started playing it with upright bass.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And was Joe playing acoustic piano, or did he have Wurlitzer, or what was he? Do you remember?
He was playing Wurlitzer piano at the time.
Because it's a Wurlitzer on the track, on the famous track.
Yeah, it was a Wurlitzer piano. And I was just thinking about this, because Sam was there. He didn't record it with us, but
uh-huh.
he was there when it first came.
Right.
Because it was a little, he was kind of reluctant. Cannon wanted him to play
Fender,
because the guys were just starting to play Fender.
Yeah.
And upright bass,
right.
And Sam would say, I'm not playing no Fender bass.
That was a controversial thing. I mean, people don't. I mean, I was 12, so I don't really remember. But I've heard from other cats, you know, about when Monk Montgomery, I guess, was like the first guy who really started playing jazz on the Fender.
Is that yeah?
And other people, it was a big deal. It's like a lot of guys, very traditional, said that's not, you know, we can't play jazz on that, man.
That's right. They didn't want to go that direction.
Right. You know, but it was so much easier to travel with and to tune and everything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, sort of inescapable.
Yeah. Like, well, when we started, Sam really didn't play it the Fender at all. I mean, the Fender bass at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just played upright. So
right.
we started playing it with the upright bass.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, after Sam left and Herbie came on the band and other bass players came on the band. They started playing Fender. Then we recorded this tune,
mm-hmm.
and it was recorded with Fender, and Joe was playing Wurlitzer and stuff.
So who played bass on the record? The
I think that was Victor Gaskin.
Gaskin.
But I think it was Victor.
But Victor was playing Fender.
Yeah,
I think of him as an upright player.
Yeah, he was playing Fender. Yeah, he was playing both. Well, they carried both basses,
right?
So he was playing both. Yeah. Yeah, so we recorded that actually right here in town. You know?
So was that a live recording, or was that like a dubbed in liveness?
It was a live recording, but what we did at that time is we recorded at Capitol Records,
right?
And they had Studio A was not like Studio A now; it's cut down, but it used to be a huge.
Oh, it was a big place. They bring in tables and drinks and stuff. Yeah.
So they put a bar up in there.
Yeah.
They set up a bar. They brought all these tables and they invited the audience and. and we just would play all night. Yeah. It was just like a club atmosphere. They put the lights down. It was the same exact.
Okay, so that was a real deal, because there was some, there's some of those Capitol albums that are like supposedly live where you can tell it's not live. They just dubbed in like crowd noises and stuff.
Yeah. No, these are all people. And first they were just friends of ours that came, you know, and then a couple other recordings we did it the same way. It was just, I mean, it was just people standing outside waiting to get into these recording sessions. Right. Yeah, it was a big deal.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that's great.
So all of a sudden, Cannon's got a hit record. I mean, he's being played on rock and roll stations. And did you guys do like American Bandstand and stuff like that?
Yeah, we did that kind of stuff. We did a lot of shows like that. We also did shows opposite rock people, which was weird, you know?
Yeah, opening for rock acts and stuff.
Well, yeah, we'd be up in San Francisco at the
Fillmore or the Winter
Auditoriums
and
things, and we'd be playing opposite groups like the Who and things like that, you know, with our little band and all that noise that they, those guys played really volume. I mean, I remember having to stand outside in between sets. But yeah, we played a lot of stuff like that. Yeah.
So how did, I like Cannonball and Nat, I mean, these guys that came out of the tradition, you know, how did they react to that? What was that like for them? I mean, all of a sudden they're like playing in front of rock audiences and white audiences, people they might not have discovered them otherwise, you know?
They loved it. Cannon was a, you know, he was a communicator. He could talk to people. Mm-hmm. You know, you could see he talked on most of the
albums, on the records, yeah. Like
that. So he loved all that stuff, you know. And he wanted another one after that. He tried to get a couple other hits after it. Mm-hmm. We had "Why Am I Treated So Bad?"
I remember that,
And a couple of things like that, you know. And some things we did with Staple Singers. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but he loved it, and it worked for him.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah.
So he didn't feel conflicted about
And guys used to say, you know, why is he playing that instead of going straight ahead? But the band was getting bigger and bigger and bigger all the time.
Yeah,
you know, we were having a ball.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, why turn your back on that? It's a good situation.
Yeah, we were playing our regular straight ahead stuff, and he was experimenting with all kinds of time. We did 74 Miles Away, which
remember
is
that,
time things, different time. And then we would play the funk things, and so we had a big repertoire to play from, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when we went in these clubs, people would call for different things, and we play them, you know, and they remember and have these things. And then we have the out things that we play that Joe wrote.
Do you think that Cannon doing Mercy Mercy and kind of getting over with that, do you think that influenced Miles? Did Miles look at that and go,
Yeah, Miles loved it. You know, I think he loved that band.
Yeah.
He loved the band when Joe was on the band. He loved it. So he used to hang with us all the time. Yeah, I think it did. And I think some of the things that Joe wrote, too, influenced Miles a lot, you know. He wrote things like Dr. Honoris Causa. He wrote In a Silent Way.
Those
things that really, you know, that Miles really loved. And
while
the recording. And also, Joe was on some of Miles' things.
So. Right, because I always thought that, like, because Miles going electric and kind of doing that sort of seemed to come out of nowhere. But I always wondered if Miles kind of looked at what Cannon was doing and said, oh, maybe this is the way to go.
Yeah, you know? I think it might have had a lot to do with it, and probably it had a lot to do with the things that Herbie and Chick were doing. Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, they came out of Miles Band.
Yeah. But I mean, when Joe formed Weather Report, you know, I think that had a big influence on
him. Oh, yeah.
Because Joe used to talk about that even when he was with our band. He was talking about going that direction, you know.
Yeah, so that was something he had to get away from Cannon to do.
Yeah,
though,
he had to leave that to do that. Yeah, exactly.
So what happened with Cannonball? I mean, he was riding pretty high, and he had hits and all that, and then it just sort of, what went on? I mean, he died young, you know?
He died at 46.
Yeah.
46. He had a stroke. He just had a stroke. That's what happened with him. He was...
He was also a large guy, we should say. He was a big man.
He was about... 240, 250.
Yeah.
240. You mean what happened to him that he got when he got sick and died?
Yeah.
Well, we were up in Indiana. We had just left Milwaukee. We had played the jazz festival up there and in Milwaukee, and the band had a few days off. We were going to Indianapolis to play. Indiana.
Yeah.
And so Nat and Booker and Joe Booker went to New York and Nat went back to New York. Mm-hmm. Joe went to LA. We just took some time off. Cannon and I just we had this van, this U-Haul truck with the instruments and stuff
yeah. in it.
And we decided to drive, and we just drove on to Indiana. And so it was him and I, and we stayed there. Gary, Indiana was mm-hmm. where we were. We stopped in Chicago, got some big, he loved to eat, so we got this barbecue.
Yeah.
And he had it all spread out in his hotel room in it when we got to Gary. And the next morning, he called me and said, why don't you meet me downstairs? We'll have breakfast in the restaurant.
Mm.
And I said, okay. And when we got downstairs, the restaurant was closed, and he was standing there trying to talk to the waitress.
Yeah.
Darling, he says, oh, we were hungry. He says, darling, why don't you open up for us and just cook us something? And while he's just talking to me, because he was a charmer.
Yeah.
And while he was talking to the waitress, he just grabbed his...
Oh, man. So you were there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He just grabbed his face and started slapping on his yeah. face and saying, his speech had been cut off right yeah. there, you know. And so we got him... We found he was having a stroke, you know. So this guy brought a car around and said, well, we'll take him to the hospital because they'll get him there faster
mm-hmm.
instead of calling an ambulance.
Right.
The hospital was just a few blocks down the street. So we got him in the car, and on the way to the hospital, we got into an automobile accident. Another car hit the car that we were in on the way.
Oh, man.
So... I had to physically lifted Cannon out of the car, man. He was like 240, but that was a small guy, but I guess it's the adrenaline. And we put him in another vehicle and got him to the hospital, and they had called ahead and let them know that he had been in an accident also.
Yeah.
And that he was had a stroke, and they were coming. So all the people were waiting outside of the hospital for him.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and they got him in. They didn't gave him all kinds of special care. But he only lasted for about a week or 10 days or something like that, I remember. He was paralyzed on one side. Yeah, so it was him and I together when it happened.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was something else.
Yeah. So that was, what happened to the band? Did Nat take over the band, or did...
Yeah, what happened is the band kind of... That was it for the band. It kind of, you know, that was kind of... And then Nat decided to go ahead and play after a little time off.
And, yeah.
And he formed a band, and so I went out and played with that. It was Booker and myself and Nat, and I think, what's his name? Charles McPherson was in the band. We toured, did a little touring and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So all this time, you were you living back in Rochester still going when you went home? Where'd you go?
No, but this time we had moved out to L.A.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 1972, we moved out to L.A. Cannon passed away in 75,
right.
But we had been in L.A. since 72.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's where I was then. And after Nat's band, you know, that stayed together for a while, but it wasn't really the same.
Wasn't the same, yeah.
You know, it wasn't the same. So I got a call. I started working with Kenny Rankin,
mm-hmm.
which was nice. I had a good time with Kenny.
Yeah.
And then we worked on and off together for quite a long time. But while I was with Kenny, about maybe a year or so after, maybe not even that long, I got a call to go with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. So I joined.
Was Al Cooper still with the band, or was this a David Clayton Thomas version?
David Clayton Thomas. Yeah. It was Larry Willis,
right.
Tony Klatka, Mike Stern was on that band.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we did that. We did one album. I did one album with him, God Bless the Child, I believe it was the album, something like that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know you were with Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Yeah, it was fun. I had a great time.
I love that band.
Don Elias was playing percussion.
Mm-hmm.
I took Bobby Columbia's left the band, I guess, right. to do, he still was the part of the band. I
right.
mean, he was the...
But he didn't travel at that point.
Yeah, I mean, he went to the business side of it.
Yeah. Yeah, he took a job with Columbia as like an A&R guy or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. Right. And so that was... So I took his place on the thing,
mm-hmm.
and it was fun. I had a great time with them.
That's cool. Yeah,
yeah, that was a whole different, another different experience. Cause right. It was so different than playing with the the jazz scene. We're kind of the rock scene, even though it was all jazz musicians in the band.
Right. Well, that was like a rock band made up of jazz guys that, or like jazz guys playing rock.
Exactly.
Yeah. Kind of. Exactly. Well, I guess when Cannonball was doing Mercy Mercy and that kind of stuff is similar.
It was similar. Yeah. But now we had the big horn section and we had all that stuff going on.
So. And that was all electric bass and electric keyboards and guitar and all that.
Yeah.
So Mike Stern in those days, man, what was he? He was making some noise, right?
Yeah, he was making some noise and he was always talking about playing jazz. You know, he loved to play straight. And I guess he's doing exactly what he was doing. And as a matter of fact, I see he's coming to town.
He comes to Catalina's every December, so he's coming. We're recording this in mid-November. He'll be here in two weeks' time. Yeah, I see him every year.
And I was telling my wife just yesterday, every time Mike's in town, I haven't seen him since Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So every time he's in town, I've been working, you know, and I haven't been able to get to see him.
Right.
Mostly because either I was out with Nancy or somebody, or I was at
Charlie O's, which we don't have anymore.
Yeah. Right. So this time when he comes in town, I'm going to be off.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going to go in and see him and say hi to him.
Yeah, that'll be cool.
First time in this long time.
A reunion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he plays really well.
He played great then.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. So, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and then what? Then what happens?
Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and then I stayed with them for a while, and I got a call to go with Sarah Vaughan.
Mm.
Sarah Vaughan. Her band broke up.
Yeah.
Something happened with her band, with her new husband and stuff like that. And first thing he did was fire her band. They had been together forever.
Yeah.
And that was Walter Booker, Jimmy Cobb, I don't remember that, and Carl Schroeder. That was a great,
good
great
band, yeah.
Section.
So who did you play with her with?
On the band with me was Andy Simpkins and Mike, what's his name? Piano player, he's in San Diego. Mike Wolford.
Oh, Mike Wolford, yeah.
Yeah, Mike Wolford. And that was the trio.
So was that the beginning? I mean, I knew Andy, but he worked with Sarah for a long, long time.
He worked with Sarah for a long time. Yeah, we worked together with Mike and Andy for quite a while.
Yeah.
And then I got fired. Me and Wayman didn't get along together. That was her new husband, and he came on the band, and we just bumped heads. And I had known him from Rochester because we had played from Rochester for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He's the weirdest guy, not just the weirdest.
Is this Wayman Reed?
Wayman Reed.
Yeah, right.
He was just so weird. And he's the one who was responsible for that Jimmy and them guys getting fired.
Oh, yeah.
So
how long were you with Sarah?
I was with Sarah for from 79, it was a year, about 79 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
And I got fired at the Hollywood Bowl right after the jazz festival. Sarah said, she says, they had just hired this new road manager. His name was Charlie Whale. He's from up in Boston. And Charlie said, Roy, I said, yeah. He says, I got some good news and some bad news.
What was the good news?
He said, it wasn't really good news, huh?
Yeah.
So he says, Sarah wanted me to give you this letter, you know, that you've been terminated.
Mm-hmm.
So then I went in and saw Sarah, and she said, because she was still there, and she said, well, it's nothing musical, it's just a personality clash. You know, she was in love with this dumb guy, and he was just messing up her stuff left and right, you know.
So who replaced you? Do you know?
I don't remember who replaced me with the band. Oh, yes, I do. It was, what's his name? He's playing with Tony Bennett now. I can't, I'll get him in a minute.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm just curious.
So
what was the good news part of that story? That's what I'm curious about.
There wasn't really no good news.
No, I didn't think so.
That was his thing. But
he was trying to soften you up.
Yeah, but the funny part about it was, you know, I didn't care because I didn't like Wayman anyway.
Yeah.
So he said, I was fine, I'm gone. And so as I was driving out of the place, out of the back of the Hollywood
Bowl,
Charlie's calling me, Roy, hold on. And I said, so I stopped the car and then rolled the window down. He said, listen, Roy, he says, I know that Sarah, you know, just gave you this notice. He said, but she wanted to know if you would come to Vegas with us tomorrow and do the benefit. So I said, no, just tell her that I can't do that.
You're declining the honor.
Right,
right. Maybe that was the good news.
Yeah, right.
The bad news is you're fired. The good news is you get to do the benefit.
Yeah. No. So we...
That's funny.
So yeah, it was funny. So she... It was quite a few, a couple of years before she wouldn't speak to me no more after that. I would see her in the clubs and things because she used to hang out at Carmelo's and all those places and stuff. And she wouldn't speak to me for a long time. And one night we were in one of those clubs. I forgot what it was. And we were sitting at the bar and she said we were pretty close at the bar. And she came over and said, you know. Oh, I know what happened. What happened is she didn't want to pay.
Yeah.
So I took her to the union to get my back pay and all that stuff. And she told me that I did her wrong trying to get the money from her from the union and all that stuff. And we talked and talked for a while, and then everything was cool after that. And she started talking again, and we started talking again. It was good, you know. I'm glad it was on that note, you know.
Yeah.
It was nice. But it was a little thing for a while.
Hmm. Well, at least it was Sarah Vaughan, you know. So, were you? You're at USC now.
Yeah.
And when did you? I'm curious. When did you get involved with like jazz education or teaching in general? Have you always taught, or is it something you?
No, not really.
Jumped into. No,
they just asked. They called me and asked me, would I be interested in teaching at USC, because they were hiring a bunch of the jazz department is all full of all the jazz musicians.
Yeah, sure. Teaching.
And I said, sure. It was about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, sure, I would love to do that. And they hired me, and I've been doing it over there ever since.
Yeah.
You know?
So tell me about like teaching, your philosophy of it, or how you approach it. I mean, are you teaching classes in drum set, or are you, what exactly do you do?
Yeah, I'm doing individual teaching over there for the guys. And,
yeah, private students.
Private students, and I also do some what they call master classes, where you talk to big classes of about 30 people.
Right.
You know, I just did two this last week for Bob Menzer's class over there. But, I just teach them what I do when I'm out there playing, and the approach that I have to playing the drum set and playing jazz. And I try to pass along those things and a little knowledge to them, you know, and the some techniques and things like that. And it seems to work, you know, the guys. And some guys are some really talented people out there.
There's some great... some great students. I don't know how sure I am that these guys are going to get jobs, but
right. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
But I love the kids. The kids are great. I love the contact I have with the teaching contact with them. It's just beautiful. You know,
that's cool.
And some kids I've had since they were freshmen until they're seniors. You know, so you get to
you develop a relationship. Yeah.
It's a nice thing. You know. And then when you go in and talk to the big master classes, you know, it's usually they want to hear about your career in jazz and what jazz was like when you were playing it and things like that. And we teach them, tell them about that. And then we usually wind up demonstrating things and then playing with them and things like that, you know.
Right. So the master classes, it's not just drummers, it's other.
It's everybody.
Right.
Yeah. All the instruments.
Right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And we play music for them and recordings and different, all kinds of stuff, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you've been doing that 10 years. So that's like back in the, you started in the late 90s?
Just playing that. And all the time still with Nancy. So the nice thing about teaching these at USC and the colleges like that, they give you they know that you have to travel, so they give you time to do that. You know?
Right. Well, I mean, part of the thing with something like that is they can say, we've got Roy McCurdy, who's a working jazz guy, and he's out with Nancy Wilson, so it behooves them to give you the time to go do what you do. Yeah.
Exactly. Like I took Peter Erskine's classes last week,
right?
Because he's in Japan.
Yeah.
You know, so we kind of switch for each other.
That's a good situation. Mm-hmm. So how'd you get with Nancy?
Well, after I left Sarah, Sarah Vaughan at the end of 1980, John Levy was Nancy's manager.
Right.
Is still Nancy's manager, and he was the manager with Cannonball. So that's kind of that.
Oh, family. So he knew you, yeah.
So the spot it just happened to fall that way. The spot it came available for me right after Sarah's thing, a few weeks after Sarah, I got the
great
call
timing.
From Nancy, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was 1980, and that gig has lasted till now.
Wow.
You know, it was like a big family anyway, so we had known each other. I had known Nancy from Cannonballs,
yeah,
and all that stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fine. And when I joined the band, it was me and John B. Williams was on the band.
Yeah.
And Mike Wolf was the musical director, mm-hmm, at that time. Yeah.
Good band.
Yeah.
And now it's Lou and...
Lou Matthews and John B. still there, yeah, and I'm there. John B. left a while to do the Arsenio Hall show.
Right.
And, right. He came back. After that,
he's playing upright or Fender.
He's playing. He plays both.
Yeah.
It depends on what he. Sometimes he brings his upright wood bass,
mm-hmm,
but he's also playing upright electric bass.
Yeah.
And then he brings the what we call the pork chop.
Yeah. So, played with singers. I mean, you've played with a fair amount of singers. It's
just about every singer.
Yeah, talk about that. I mean, what's it to, like, playing with singers is different than playing with Cannon or something. How do you change your approach, or what do you have to do
when
you're
playing
with a singer?
Well, I just play, you just have to play with the same intensity as you would with the horn, but it's just more subtle. You just don't overplay them. You know, you don't have as much bombacity as you would if you were playing behind horns and things like that. So
right.
I just kind of bring it down, and it's a more... It's a tastier thing too, you know. There's a lot of brushes and things involved, and things like that. You just have to listen, because a singer is you can't cover them, you know.
Right.
You can't like you. So I kind of got a reputation of playing with a lot of singers. I've played with a lot of singers. I played with just about everybody, from Betty to Carmen McRae to Ella, and of course Sarah and Nancy, and then Joe Williams and Billy Eckstein, all these kind of people like that.
Yeah.
So just a lot of different singers.
Mark Murphy, I see on your bio.
Mark Murphy, yeah. Kenny. I mean, you can just go ahead and name all that. Just about everyone I've been with at one time or other, played gigs with at one time or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's definitely different. It's a different approach when you work with a singer than when you work with a band.
Yeah.
And usually you're working, I guess, in most of your experience has been with singers with trios.
The trios.
So everything really counts. Yeah. You know, you can't hide.
Yeah, and trios and with Nancy and Ella and Sarah, it was trio, and it was also a big band.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also they had big band books, and they also had symphony books.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so you
got to go out and do all that.
All those different things. Yeah.
So what context is your favorite? Do you like small groups, big bands?
I like small groups.
Yeah.
I love quartets, quintets,
mm-hmm,
you know, that era, that kind of thing. Like that.
Yeah.
Sextets, that's good. You know?
Yeah.
That's my favorite to play, because that's really my way of playing, but I love to play all kinds of ways, you know. And I've been fortunate. I've been able to play all different kinds of, you know, things. I started out playing blues before jazz.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, just blues.
Who'd you play with? Anybody we know or
well, I played
local cats.
Yeah, I play a lot of local blues around Rochester, and then I wound up playing. Well, I went out and played with John Mayall for a while, and I played with Eddie Cleanhead Vincent for a while. Did his stuff. I played with him when I was a kid, and I wound up playing him when I was grown.
That's cool.
And just different kinds like that. They're just really great. One, the band I was in was called Count Rabbit and His Bunnies. It was albino guitar player, man, and he
really
played his butt off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Count Rabbit and His Bunnies.
Yeah.
Any pictures of that around?
No, I wish there was. You know, but I played with a lot of those kind of guys, a lot of blues guys.
Yeah.
A lot of rhythm and blues, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
so we did a lot of that. My first professional gig, other than the going out with the jazz tech, but my first with playing professionals was at 16 years old. My first gig was with Roy Eldridge.
Oh,
yeah, I was too young to be in the clubs. My father would come with me and be in the clubs all the time.
That's great. Did you study drums or percussion, or how did you get? How did the whole drum thing come about?
Well. My cousin used to play drums a little bit, but he played marching drums, so the drums were always around the house, and I was always interested in that and drum corps stuff too, because I saw that all the time.
Uh-huh.
So I started playing that. Then I was hearing all the music in the house all the time. We heard the jazz and Philharmonic stuff all the time. I still have some of those records.
Yeah, it's great records.
And I became interested in the drum set.
Mm-hmm.
And then my sister bought me my first drum set when I was about 8 years old.
Wow.
I started playing. And then seeing all those people come through town with when my father was booking places. I got a chance to see Louis Belson play with the with Duke's band.
Yeah.
And saw Buddy play, all those guys. So I got interested in that, and that's how it happened. And I started taking lessons, and I took lessons for a long time. Then I went to Eastman and studied with Bill Street.
Ah, so did you study mallets and stuff too, or just drum set?
Just drums, yeah. Just drums. And mostly, it wasn't really drum set that I was studying rudimental drumming.
Oh.
Yeah, with Bill Street there. Which was great for my hands. And
oh,
stuff,
yeah,
and
sure.
Which transferred, because I was doing a lot of professional corps marching, you know mm-hmm. traveling with drum corps at that
yeah.
time and doing competitions and stuff. So that was my thing, you know.
So you learned how to read and
yeah.
drive a big band and
yeah.
all that stuff.
Yeah, and I learned mostly learned how to drive. I didn't really play a big band until most of the big band I started was in when I was in the service.
Uh-huh.
Because I was playing these shows with the big bands, you know.
Right.
And then we were playing a lot of Glenn Miller kind of types of things, you know.
Well,
but
got to do what you got to yeah. do, you know.
But I learned the stuff from there, and
yeah.
then we transferred on. Yeah. From
yeah. So that's cool. So you had the education, then when you got to USC, that's a way of sort of using
yeah,
it and
yeah,
paying it back.
Yeah, it's great. I love teaching. I also teach privately at home.
Yeah.
You know? But sometimes you run into regular guys that just play and they're just doing it, you know.
Yeah.
But then you run into some really exceptional people, you know, that can really play.
Oh yeah, teaching is inspiring. It really is.
Yeah,
and the good thing about teaching is you gotta have your stuff together, because when somebody says, "Well, how do you do that?" you gotta have an answer.
Exactly.
You can't just say, "I don't know." You just do it. You
and
know?
You have to be able to play it too.
Yeah, you gotta be able to show it.
Demonstrate
yeah.
it.
Gotta bring
them.
It. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
That's cool. So now you're at USC. You've got Nancy when she works.
When she works.
And you're in the studios a little bit, doing some stuff.
Yeah, you know, just recordings. I do record mostly a lot of jazz recordings.
Right.
I've done a few. Movies. I just recently I've been getting calls to do some movies. The last movie I did was Rum Diaries. Was
right.
Was just
opened.
Just
yeah.
opened with Christopher Young was the he wrote all the music for that. And that was very interesting, because after we finished that, we did about a year or so ago.
Yeah.
And he decided he wanted to do the score. He had just had a great time because we had a lot of jazz musicians on that particular score.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided he wanted to do the score at Catalina's.
Oh, right. You did a live night.
So we
right.
did a live night there with about 30 musicians.
That's cool.
It was really nice.
How did you get 30? You and I talked about this before, but getting 30 musicians on that stage at Catalina's.
It was amazing. I mean, it was, they were off, and they were partly off the stage.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they had strings and, you know, horns and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of people on that stage.
Yeah.
It was hard to get all those people in the place that we went to rehearse.
Yeah, I mean, but once you get about 12 guys on that stage at Catalina's, you're
yeah.
pretty full,
it
you know?
It was squeezed
yeah.
together, really squeezed together.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun, and now I'm not sure, but I heard from his person, Sam, and she said that he's so hyped up about it, he's thinking about maybe doing it again before the end of the year.
Oh, cool.
So
at Catalina's?
I don't know
yeah.
if it's going to be there or not, but it would be fun to do. I had a great time doing it, you know?
That's cool. Yeah. Cool.
It's kind of Latin tinge because the whole movie was around in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, right. Right. Who were some of the other guys on that on the date? You remember?
John B. was in there
yeah.
playing. Tom Rotella was playing guitar
mm-hmm.
on there. Well, let me see. They had John Mayer play piano on some of the stuff. Wow, who else? There was a lot of different guys. I must tell you, though, there was a lot of studio guys that I hadn't known, really.
Right.
You know, so. But a lot of those three guys. I was trying to think of the others. My memory's gone.
No, that's okay. That's all right.
Yeah, it was a lot of guys.
That sounds like a fun thing.
It was fun, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know any of the string players, but it was.
Right, well, they keep to themselves anyway. They're a different breed. They're a different breed, those guys.
Yeah.
That's cool. That sounds like a good experience. So talk a little bit about Charlie O's, about that experience. You did the house trio there.
Yeah.
So you were there most Friday and Saturday nights,
mostly
right?
Mostly Friday and Saturday night for about just a little over 10 years.
Yeah. Were you there the last night? Were you playing the last night when they just said, this is it, guys?
I did, yeah. Joanne called. We were scheduled to play with Janice Mann that night.
And the vocalist, Janice Mann. Yeah.
Janice Mann. And I got a call from Joanne about 4 in the afternoon, and she said that this was going to be the last night. And so she just wanted to let us everybody know she was going to close after that.
Yeah.
It was the last day of the month, too, and I think maybe she didn't want to go into the next month or whatever, you know.
Right.
But that was a great experience. We played there for all that time on Friday and Saturdays. We left to go do gigs and come back. It was like a house gig for me and John Hurd. We
were there. John Hurd, the bass player. Yeah, and various piano players or one guy? Or?
Various piano players all through the time. John Hurd was the leader of the band. And Andy Langham was the last piano player we had. But we had several people over the years that played in that band.
Right.
And the horn players changed every all the time.
Yeah, it was like a trio with a featured horn player, sometimes a vocalist.
Yeah, so every horn player in town and some people from out of town played in there at one time.
That was a good gig.
It was a great gig, you know.
Well, it lasted.
And Joanne and Charlie, I love Charlie and Joanne. They would just be beautiful, you know. And they, you know.
I like Charlie O's. It was a real jazz joint, you know. It was a real jazz clubs come and go, but Charlie O's really had that good jazz joint feel. You know?
And they loved the musicians. You know? They loved the guys, you know. So that was one of the main things about that, you know. And I think if Charlie was still alive, the club would be there. Still,
right.
You know?
It was too much for Joanne to do without him.
Without him, and she had her health was getting bad and stuff like that. You know, so it was a big burden. You know, it was Charlie's baby.
Yeah.
You know, and she would come in and be there with him. You know, because she had another job.
Yeah.
But then she found he wound up being the whole person, the main person. You know?
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, a jazz club is not an easy thing to do.
No.
It's just, speak about, I mean, if you have thoughts about just sort of the disappearing live jazz scene, I mean, at least in L.A., you know, there's not a lot of places left.
Not in L.A., is it?
Why is that? I mean, all the musicians are here. I mean, there's a lot of good musicians here, but there's no place.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I hate to say it, but it's not really supported by the people.
No, it's not. Well, don't hate to say it, because it's true.
It's true, you know.
Everybody says it, but nobody does anything about it.
Yeah, nobody comes out, you know, and then they cry about it when it's, you know, they complain about the clubs when they're open. And
right.
When the clubs are not there, then, you know, they complain. They don't come out to the clubs when they're open.
Yeah.
I go in New York and play the Dizzy's and all those clubs in New York, and they're all packed.
Yeah.
All packed, you know. Oh, here you can throw a goddamn ball through there. Sorry to swear, but
that's okay. That's okay.
You can throw, you know, it's nobody.
The support isn't there. I mean, it's kind of like this theoretical support. You know, people say, oh man, I wish there was a really good jazz club.
Yeah.
And somebody opens up a good jazz club and they don't go. Or they go once and then that's it. They felt like I've paid my dues. I've gone and I don't have to go anymore.
Right. I can't tell you how many times I played at the jazz bakeries with just super name people.
Yeah, with nobody there.
There'd be nobody there, or half a thing, or they wouldn't even have a second show, or, you know, because it was no support.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing about that. I was talking with somebody else once about having just played a gig at the Jazz Bakery, and we both agreed that we both knew the sound of the room when it was full and when it was empty, because we both played there so many times when it was either way, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you can't think, you know, the classic jazz era, Shelley's Manhole, stuff like that here, those clubs were never empty. They were always packed.
Always,
you know?
Packed. And I played those places, Shelley's and the places, it was always packed.
Yeah.
When I played them, you know. It's. I would talk to people in Charlie's and they'd be complaining, you know, oh, they aren't doing this, they aren't doing that here. This club is that. And I used to tell them, what, you know, if you didn't have this club, what would you be doing now? Would you still be? Now they don't have it.
Right.
So now, what are they
Well,
doing?
We don't have Spazio. We don't have Charlie O's.
Right.
I mean, those were places that were booking jazz 5-6 nights a week, you know, 6-7 nights a week in some cases.
Right.
And that's two clubs in the last 2 years that are just gone.
Exactly.
You know, there's Vitello's, and that's good, but, you know, you can't replace two with one.
No. And so that's what happened. So they're you know, it's gone, by the way. And then the little clubs that are open up is not the same.
Yeah.
No, it's not the same. They have a couple of clubs that open up down in Little Tokyo.
Mm-hmm. The Blue Whale and things like that.
I'm not sure about the Blue Whale. I haven't been in there, so I can't say anything about it. But there's other clubs down there that open up, and there's their policy is so strange.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's the music policy, you mean?
The music and the way they, their musician policy, the way they want to pay, and all
yeah.
kinds of stuff like that. So, you know, it's just weird, you know, so. You know, they want you, what this one place wants you to bring in, well, they want the musicians to bring in at least $1,700 a night worth of business. You
right.
know? You know,
pretty hard to do in L.A. and playing
in LA,
jazz.
You know,
yeah.
yeah you know, and things like that. And but they aren't advertising that much themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard.
Yeah, it's a tough situation.
Mm-hmm.
It is. Live. That's why, you know, I go back to, like, the jazz education thing, because we talk, you know, you teach, I teach. We talk about, we have these great students.
Yeah.
I just wonder where they're going to go with it. You know,
yeah.
it's if there's going to be someplace left for them to make a living.
Right. Exactly.
As the studio scene shrinks and the jazz scene shrinks, and even the jazz education scene eventually will have to shrink.
Right.
So where, you know, where are they going to put what we teach them?
Yeah, that's right. And they're turning them out left and right.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you're right. Exactly right. Where are they going to work, you know? So it's going to be an overload for sure.
Yeah.
Especially in the jazz part.
Well, it kind of reminds me of, like, you know, you're standing in front of a mirror and you put a mirror in back and you see this, like, endless sort of hall of mirrors. And it's like, okay, so we teach some kid to play and to teach. And he goes out and he teaches, he makes a living teaching other kids to teach
right.
and other kids to teach. But where's the practice of it? You know,
yeah.
where's the actual
yeah, where,
doing
where,
of it?
And that's funny because when I first went to New York, well, even before I went to New York, it was no doubt that's what I wanted to do.
Right. And there would be a place to do
and
it.
There would be a place to do it, you know. And,
yeah.
and we didn't worry about a place to play. Our worry was when can we get there?
Right,
know?
Right,
when
yeah.
can we be good enough to be there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. But now, yeah, you have to worry about, well, getting your profession together and if I'll be able to apply it afterwards.
Right. You know? And L.A. is a unique, you know, it's a unique situation because we have a couple of good rooms. We have Catalina's.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to think of what the other one would be, but we have at least Catalina's.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people that you never really see here. Or if you see them, they do one night on their way to Japan or on their way back from Japan or something.
Right.
That, oh, yeah, okay, I'll play L.A., you know, one night. It's very hard to get someone to come out here and do a week,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's weird because there's a lot of musicians here and there's a lot of people who have the money to go out and see live jazz and get a babysitter and pay for parking and all that. But
yeah.
support isn't there, you know.
And when we used to come through here with Cannonball's band, Sonny Rollins bands, mm-hmm. all those bands like that, all the gigs were a week.
Yeah. Oh, it was always a week.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sometimes it were 2 weeks, but it'd be a week for sure.
Oh, you'd settle in, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Concerts by the Sea, the Lighthouse.
Yeah, Shelley's.
You know? Shelley's.
Then we go up to San Francisco and do the work jazz workshop.
Yeah, jazz workshop, Yoshi's, you know, all those
yeah,
places.
Yeah, then we go up from there to Vancouver and do a week or two up in the clubs that they had. They had a couple of jazz clubs up there.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was a kid here in L.A., all these bookings, yeah, were a week, 10 days, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I could go see Wes Montgomery on Monday
mm-hmm.
and then go back and catch him on Friday sure. and then maybe go the next week.
Yeah.
And by the way, for $3, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But
the Lighthouse, we worked at the Lighthouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. The Lighthouse, Shelley's, the Lighthouse, and Concerts by the Sea. I mean, those were three rooms that were busy six, seven nights a week.
All the time.
And not with, you know, five guys named Fred. I mean, with real jazz stars,
right,
you know?
Right.
And that's over.
Right.
I mean, it's just over.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then you had the little local rooms that were.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the little smaller rooms, too, you know, that people were playing in. Those were going on 7 nights a week. Too,
yeah. So. Well, every little room had a. You had to have live music.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to have live music. That was part of the deal,
yeah.
you know? It's like you would not have a band, I mean, any more than you would not have beer,
yeah.
you know? You had to have it. And
they were all most instrumental gigs,
yeah.
too. You know, now that's one thing that's changed over the years that I've noticed. We were always playing, when I was out there playing with all these bands, they were all instrumental bands.
Right.
All instrumental bands. And then when I did work with singers, it was their trio. Now it's a lot of singers.
Yeah.
Any instrumental bands.
Yeah.
You know,
to make
people come out at all, it seems like you have to be a singer there or something. You know,
it's either you do or the club owners think you do, and that ends up being the same thing.
Exactly,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The singers will bring in people and, you know, singers bring in the women bring the men in, and that's, you know, that's
yeah,
how it goes.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, they say to me, well, you coming in with your band? Who's going to be singing with you?
Well, yeah, right.
I'm coming in with an instrumental band, you know,
yeah.
not going to sing this time, you know. So.
Yeah, it's a strange scene. It's a strange scene.
Yeah.
Well, you've seen it come and go, man. You've seen a lot of it,
seen
you know.
A lot of it since the early 60s.
Yeah.
Actually from 59 to really till now, which is great.
I mean, and you're in good shape too. I mean, it's just people can draw their own conclusions about how old you are, judging by who you played with. But I mean, you look like a guy who's 30 years younger than you are.
Well, thank you, man. And yeah, well, you know, I'm a gym guy. I try to take care of myself, so I go to the gym. I just went to the gym before I came here. And this month is my birthday. My birthday is the 28th of this month. I'm 75.
Good for you.
Yeah. So.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
You're doing something right. You're doing something right. And your cousin Ron he's at USC as well, right?
He's up there. He teaches all kinds of classes there, mostly big band stuff and all kinds of things he's teaching.
So that's cool. You guys hang out? You're close?
Yeah, if we get a chance to. He's been really busy for the last few years, not only at USC, but he travels with his band. He has a band that's traveling too. And then he was doing a Langston Hughes project that he was traveling with. But now he's going to take his band into Catalina. So he's coming into Catalina in about a week or so.
Cool.
A week or two, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's nice.
Well, Roy, thank you, man.
My pleasure.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah, beautiful.
I appreciate it.
All right.
Hey, it's Rick Fleshman on the Afterbeat. When Roy McCurdy left the studio, I was sweeping up after and I found a few bits that I had not known that were there. Roy talking about the early days with Betty Carter and a few other things, sort of a little transition between Betty and Cannonball. So it's a little bonus for all of you who made it this far. Thanks a lot. Enjoy. So Betty Carter, what was that like?
Betty was fun. She was...
Was she crazy?
Not then.
Yeah.
You know, then she was pretty humble and pretty quiet, actually. You know, when she
quiet
was...
Quiet Betty Carter?
Yeah. She did... She changed a lot later on in the years, but she... She was a pretty quiet person, just sang her behind often, and I worked with her individually, but it was actually me, Ron Carter, and Harold Mayburn.
Mm-hmm.
And then she did a tour with us to Japan with Sonny's band.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
cool. So how long were you with Betty?
Yeah, well, I worked with Betty for a couple of years off and on from 1961 through 63.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so by the time I saw Betty Carter, man, she was this legendary sort of like crazy chick.
You know?
And great singer, of course.
Yeah. She turned that way afterwards.
Yeah.
She was kind of a dominant person. She had a lot of different personnel coming through her band.
Mm-hmm.
Sonny did too. He had a lot of personnel coming through. The rhythm sections kind of stayed the same a lot, and sometimes it was just trio, but he would add a lot. Sometimes you'd come onto the band and go to New York to go on tour, and the band would be completely different, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know.
And he wouldn't tell you.
He did. He'd go, oh, we're going to try this guy here and see what happens. One time I went, it was with Spanky DeBress on bass, and Grant Green was playing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And then he had, we went to New York. It was Paul Blay, myself, Henry Grimes, and Betty Carter was the singer.
Wow.
You know, so.
So Betty Carter was singing with Sonny.
Yeah, she did the singing, yeah.
So did she do like songs and you guys backed her up, or was she sort of like another instrument in the band?
No, she just did her own thing and the rhythm section took care, you know, went back behind her. Wow. Yeah.
It's hard to see Grant Green fitting in with Sonny. I mean, he was like coming out of the sort of funk, soul, jazz approach, and Sonny was so wide open.
Yeah,
know?
it's true.
Did that work?
They sounded really good. Yeah, it was a really good band. It was a band that you had to keep your eye on because you know they were into certain things, and so you know you had to make sure they got there on time.
Right.
And Sonny did.
There's a lot of stories about Grant either not showing up or having to be, you know, pulled onto the bandstand and stuff
Oh, yeah. It's like we'd be on it'd be time to hit at 9 o'clock in a club and, you know, Spanky would be in the bathtub.
Yeah.
You know, things like that, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty well known jazz musicians at that time had not so great habits sometimes.
Right, exactly. And, exactly.
Sometimes they got in the way, you know.
Exactly.
That's how it was. We lost a lot of good guys. I mean, Grant died very early.
Yeah. Know? We lost a lot of good guys, especially when I was in New York. A lot of guys were gone.
Well, that was that period. You were there for like the real bebop thing.
Right,
you know?
right.
Yeah, and the period just after that, I guess, too.
Yeah, and playing with most of all those guys, you know. So,
Rochester,
mm-hmm.
What was that like?
my hometown. It was just a quiet, quiet town, but it had a lot of jazz going on. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really that whole upstate New York thing was a whole had a lot of jazz from Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, all the way over into Albany.
Yeah, great. There's a lot of guys from Buffalo.
Great players came out of there, you know. Yeah. And so we had, and the Eastman School of Music was there, so that brought players in too, you know.
So what'd your folks do?
My folks, my father had a catering service.
Yeah.
And my mom, she was home, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got, I know you got a brother.
I have a cousin, Ron McCurdy.
Ron McCurdy.
Yeah,
oh, yeah,
plays trumpet. Yeah.
Okay. You got a brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters, but they're not here anymore. Uh-huh. Yeah, they're older. I was the baby.
Yeah, you were the baby.
Yeah.
So was there a lot of music in the house? Was it? Who else played? A
lot of music. Nobody played really, like professional. My father played piano just a little bit, just around the house, just to play.
Mm-hmm.
We always had. He could always sit down and play some stuff, you know. But he wasn't a professional musician.
Right.
There was a lot of music going on in the house because they were playing records and things all the time, you know, and my sisters were.
Yeah.
So we heard a lot of jazz and a lot of whatever, blues, mm-hmm. a lot of stuff like that.
Did people come through town? I mean, was Rochester any place that, you know, the Basie band stopped or whoever?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, my dad became a like a promoter for one time.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and so I got a chance to see all these people. And he used to bring, I remember there used to be a list of guys that he'd have and. And you'd see Stan Kenton, you'd see Bull Moose Jackson, people like Tiny Bradshaw, all those people on the list, you know. And he'd bring all these people to the town for dances.
Yeah.
They would play dances,
right.
You know, and, you know, it was great. And I'd get a chance to go and hang and see all these guys play.
That was cool.
Yeah. Ellington, cool. I remember he brought the Ellington band in one time. It was incredible.
So he was like a big-time promoter.
Yeah, just, well, big for Rochester for a time.
He did big it
for
fish a, in a small pond.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So he did it for a while. I did it for a while. And it was great. I wouldn't have got a chance to see all these people like that, but it was just right there firsthand.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. That's cool.
Yeah.
So what gets you out of Rochester? College, the Army, what?
No, I went into the service, but what got me out of Rochester was going to join the Art Farmer Benny Golson Jazz Tet.
Yeah.
You know, once I got there, did that, I didn't go back to
That's
Rochester.
It. Did you play in the service? Were you like Special Forces? What do they call that?
Special Forces?
Not Special Forces, the entertainers in the Army.
It was called Special Services.
Special Services, that's what I was thinking.
I was a musician. I played in a band, and the whole time I was there, we just traveled around, did shows.
Yeah.
And I wasn't any place exciting. I was in Texas, and I went to Alaska. But we've traveled all over those areas, all the way into Seattle, doing shows for the troops and things like that.
So were you playing with anybody who later came out and made a noise, or was it just guys who came out and went into real estate or something?
Yeah, no, there was a couple of good players in, but nobody had ever showed up doing anything afterwards. You know? I've run into a lot of the guys I've been in the service with in different cities when they've come to the shows and say, hey, remember we were up there in Alaska together or someplace?
Not that you're going to forget being in Alaska. That's funny.
But nobody that really came out. There was one guy named Roger Fleming who could really play. Mm-hmm. Really great piano player. I think he came off the Baltimore area. But I lost track of him, and I never know what happened to him again, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes you talk to, like I remember I had a professor in school who was in, like the Air Force band. He was in the Air Force band with like all the cats.
Right.
It's like, I can't imagine anyone ever flew a plane. They must have been jamming all the time because he was in the Air Force band with like all the jazz guys.
Right.
And then some people were in the band. They were like the only one who ever made a noise afterwards.
Yeah,
you know, you're that guy.
Yeah, I'm that guy. Yeah. Like Cannon had a band. He was like the band leader of the Army band that he was in. And a lot of guys came out of that band that he was in, you know, so.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It gets to be like a little incubation thing you know, for some people. Mm-hmm. And then for some people, it's like, no big thing.
Yeah, you know, so I just left them, and I went back to Rochester, and I wasn't home maybe 2 weeks, and I was starting to play in the band.